Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
Chopping is still there?
Oh, that's better.
Okay. Yeah, when it first went into the call, you heard me say something because it just went... I was like, ah! So I just popped my headphones off, but then it stopped.
That's still going to be the bummer for this episode, Maggie. Going, ah! That was great.
Welcome to Polycast 272, the first one of 2017. I'm still Makalua, and with me as usual is Dan Q.
It's Polycast, year 11.
That Jin.
I is here, at least for a moment.
And the main team.
I am now a better person in the relative sense, apparently.
Okay.
Perfect sound effect. We'll just keep that.
Yeah,
that goes along with my statement. Sure.
Why was it the laptop hand kicking you?
Yes, it was.
A patch?
Yeah, right after we stop recording for the year, there's a patch. What?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I turned off my computer for the year.
Well, you had the reasons for the computer going off.
Yeah, a little bit. It's still off, by the way, so, you know, or at least no interwebs for updates. So I don't even know how this works. There was a winter 2016 update. There's an Earth map on standard size, but it's not true start location, so people are still pissed at it and waiting for a new one.
There's an alert. Historical simulation.
Well, if you have Earth map, you have true start location options.
It would be nice to have CSL on there.
Yeah, map, it's kind of the point of the Earth map.
And random Earth can be fun, too. It's just not what we usually pick to do.
Yep. And on standard size map, too, it's pretty small.
Yeah.
It'd be better if that was on, like, a huge map.
Yeah, you're locked to standard.
Europe's always fun on those.
Okay, that's the part I want to complain about. Why would you lock it into one size?
There's a lot of people that's handcrafted.
Handcrafted on a decent map size, then. It was huge by default in Civ 4.
Oh,
maybe they
know
that, like, you can't actually finish a game on huge unless you have the patience of, like...
The people that play Marathon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The one variation you can get with the Earth map is the start location is either standard or balanced. But it's an Earth map, so there really isn't. I mean,
it ain't gonna be balanced.
I know.
I think they mean that you will vaguely have a strategic resource near you if you select balanced.
Okay, adding an alert action for units because people wanted alert action.
That's actually not true.
Yeah.
So if they added an alert button for units, they did not add an alert action for units. The button still does nothing. Last time checked.
You put a unit to sleep.
Yeah. Alert equals sleep. Have fun with that, guys.
They do like they used to with that, where they sentry them, and if something comes along, they'll wake up.
Sometimes. Not always. Maybe.
Yeah.
Otherwise, religious units may now fortify until healed. Weirdly, that never actually works.
Why don't they make that option useful before they allow more units to do the noob trap?
Well, the problem with this one is that religious units have to be near a holy site, but you could still fortify them until healed.
Yeah. Or so it's even the same just straight as fortifying a military unit that has no strategic resource at the moment until healed. You can just stay there forever until you hook up a resource. But because of what it does to your movement, it's an actively bad option right now on a consistent basis. It's like instant annexing cities in Civ 5. There's no reason you should do it.
Coastal raids can now pillage districts in addition to the buildings. Yay!
Ooh. Even more fun stuff.
Great admirals are no longer allowed to spawn on wonders in water tiles. How is this a gameplay update?
When they spawn in a lake...
That's a bug fix. This is not gameplay update.
You never know. Your naval dominance of that lake could have made a difference in the game.
Totally.
Well, see, my interpretation of that is that it was initially intended that great admirals could become stranded in lakes because it was an update to gameplay, not a bug fix.
Yeah, no.
That's my take. I'd believe almost anything regarding what was intended versus not at this point. I will just leave it at that.
Okay. Industrial zones and entertainment districts can no longer mass overlap. Yay!
Yeah, that was a small power spike when you got it, just a bit of a power spike.
It kind of forced a playstyle that was just dumb.
Now, for those who can still get through a game, the factories are still good. You should still build them, but...
Yes, they're good for what they're really meant to do, which is provide production to cities that don't have production from factories themselves. Yeah. Or, you know, do a wave of factories over an empire.
Not absurd, where you have random low-pop junk cities coughing up units every couple turns, because you have major overlap.
That, too... It pretty much also means that you need a taller city to get more stuff done and not crap ton of two-pop cities that are running factories.
Well, sort of. I mean, that's really only true if you're not going for domination. Because factoried cities that are like 4 to 7 pop can still crank out units, especially if you bother with the production booster, pretty fast. You have a lot of
defense. As people talked about on the forums, it would be nicer if the adjacency bonus of the industrial zone was the thing being put out across the 6X or 9X. Yeah. Or
that would do a lot to make city placement matter more than it currently does, that's for sure. I would agree with that.
That means industrial zone location would matter a bit more. That'd be good.
Choices mattering more is very helpful in this game. It needs as much of that as you can get right now.
Of course, that means they'll get more people whining that they're like, oh my god, I can't just drop a factory wherever I feel like it.
I don't care. The choices you make need to matter, because otherwise they're not really choices. But not in the strategy sense.
Now, for multiple stadiums for the whole entertainment zone one, that one's a little more questionable, because there's not really that many unique number of amenities out there.
People built those?
Oh, yeah. They used to go to my stadium.
Cool. I mean, I guess it makes it harder to do that 200-plus pop city.
Nah, it makes it harder to do the 30-pop city, or even the 25-pop city.
Well, I didn't care normally.
Because I like having one big city that runs the factories and the stadiums for all the little crappy cities around it that happen to have decent locations for other stuff.
Okay. I built them here and there previously, but entertainment districts were not in my top 2 or 3 districts, typically.
No, generally not, but if you run out of sources of luxuries or other stuff.
It beats Rebels, true.
Yeah. Plus, extra 10% on everything is pretty good. And growth.
Quite frankly, even when you do get Rebels, they are really not that much of a concern.
Not that they're like used to be,
That's the last thing you want to see is more crap you have to deal with at the end of the game.
Fortunately, they're few and they're not very intelligent about what they do.
The bigger problem I find with Rebels is when you hit that mid-game where you get civil engineering and you have the automatic walls of 200 strength, Rebels can't do anything to that.
Yeah.
They just go, ooh, nice walls, smash face, oops, never mind.
We really didn't need automatic walls ever.
No.
No, that, and Rebels realize, they should realize, I'm not going to be able to attack the city, so I should just be pillaging nonstop. Yeah. And they're really very inconsistent in doing that. They move here, and then they move back, and they move here, and they move back, and it's just...
They're just making up their minds.
Well, the thing is, pillage takes an entire action, for the most part, which means they move to go pillage something, and then they go, oh, wait, I can't pillage, so I must as well move again. That's just bad logic programming.
Yeah.
Other than that, increased research costs of techs and civics, progressively, but even still, meh.
It's a start.
Well, constantly increasing the cost without actually making fundamental changes to the tech tree to actually have progression properly. At some point, you're going to get in there and it's like, oh, nope, Eurekas. You have to get all the Eurekas because the costs are too high. So you switch the game from getting the Eurekas sometimes to must always get, which is annoying.
I guessed. And I agree that there are fundamental issues with the tech trade, but at the same time, the general cost of technologies relative to unit production, unit movement, and all that is fast, very fast. It's the kind of thing where if somebody's teching decently, you can march an army to them and they advance an era start to finish. Like, come on.
No, there's that, but there's other ways to do it. Like, you can reduce the science from pop from 0.7 per pop to, say, 0.3, like civics, or 0.5, and then campuses all of a sudden become important.
Yeah, I guess.
at least sufficiently more important than they are at the moment.
That, in effect, still raises tech cost. I mean, I guess it makes it a little bit more investment-oriented, which would be better, yes, because then you actually have to decide to build something if you want to tech better. A better way of increasing the tech costs, but yeah, it's still increasing it, which needs to be done anyway.
It also means that White Empire can't just, like, mass pop versus actually having to drop a campus or two.
I guess. The pop you get from White Empire is pretty limited compared to what you can get if you are willing to drop, like, two campuses on your 10-city empire and throw a couple buildings in them. That will annihilate having no campuses and just a bunch of cities.
Only to a certain point.
You need a ton of cities to match, like, two campuses with the university in them.
Like, no, not really. You can get away with it. It depends on what policies you pick. Did you get a great scientist to boost it up even further? But the library in the university is only worth 6 science without any modifiers. So 6 science divided by 0.7, blah, 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 math, somewhere in here. You need about 8
divided
or 9.
Divided by a frac.
Yeah, 8 or 9 pop to match that. Again, there's also adjacency bonus, so that raises it up even further. But
it's plus 100% modifier.
The modifiers are definitely, especially the building-based one. Specialists are only worth 2. It's not really that much.
Yeah, still, you need a lot of cities or a lot of growth, because if you're talking 7, 8, 9 pop, you have to invest in housing to get there.
Yeah,
or you do, though. That's
base housing on a river is 5. So you need to build a granary and a water mill and a couple farms, and all of a sudden you're up at 7 or 8.
That's a lot of stuff to put together just to get there, though.
Not really. That's like 2 buildings and a couple farms. Whoop-dee-doo.
I don't want to build friggin' buildings. I want units and additional cities. Because the cost trade-off on additional cities right now is nonsense. You should build as many as you can as quickly as you can.
Well,
as long as you don't get killed. But you're not optimized for cities if you get killed.
Well, amenities need to drive you into rebels a little sooner.
But they don't, so they just keep going for cities.
Yeah.
Besides, you can pick up amenities through luxuries that way.
Well, at a certain point, you hit too many cities.
It's very difficult to do that.
What I'm really missing from the balance change list, of course, is what we've talked about before with district cost scaling.
That's not in yet.
I was really disappointed in not seeing that on here.
Why is it attached to what it is?
It's idiotic.
There's no sense to it. There's no sense to it.
I mean, sure, some of the other stuff they talked about, it needed to be changed as well, but I don't understand the prioritization of what got in here as opposed to what didn't.
Now, districts, very simple formula. The more you build, the more they cost. Very simple. Do it that way.
That would have been better than making it so you want to rush a whole bunch of them out as soon as possible before teching, yes.
Yes, it's just retarded.
Seeing as how they've already got the, oh, no, I'm sorry, you can't construct any more districts until you reach X pop. It's not like, oh, no, we don't have any concept of that whatsoever in the game already. Yeah, you do.
Yep.
Just keep going.
Yep. The more you build of one type, the more costly it gets. And then you can limit it to say, okay, well, it starts getting really expensive if you go, say, like 4 over. But not that extra expensive if you go 1 or 2 over. And just scale it so that, you know, once you start, say, building 5 commerce districts more than any other thing, because that's the first thing you chose to build, then yes, that should get, like, brutally expensive to build another one.
My gosh, even in the later games, like, okay, city-states, bonuses, is there any production in here to constructing districts? Oh, please, please, I'm just... It's like I'm having to prioritize that more than I should. Or it's also, you know what, I'd really like this city, this is a good spot, this would be great, but by the time it's going to be able to do much of anything for me, it's going to be too late. And
as long as we don't get to the point where we're, like, throwing down holy sites or junk like that, just so that you make districts cost less than other cities, I don't want that trade-off to start showing up.
Well, no, that kind of is, because the point is you're building an empire, you're not building, you know, a commerce district.
Well, are you saying you have to build every district type, or are you just saying you have to mix it up to some extent? What's really the constraint there? Because if you're having to build, like, all the districts, even ones that are otherwise junk, I don't like that any better than the current model. If you have to build other districts, but you get penalized for spamming one that's stronger relative to the others, that's okay.
But if you keep the relative to the others, you have to keep all the others in.
Or do you just have to have X number of other types?
Nope, I would say all the others because you have to deal with it. Now, granted, all the others could be nuanced quite a bit. Like, if you have no coastal cities and no ability to produce a harbor, then harbor should not affect the map.
And
because that makes no sense. Like, oh, now I have to go plant a new city just so that it can build a harbor to build. No, that doesn't make sense.
Because if you don't have sites and not having a religion.
Yeah, I would say if you don't have a religion, that you wouldn't need to ban holy sites.
Okay.
You would need to. I would still have holy sites as part of it, because you should still be building faith, even if you're a follower, but maybe half as much as if you were a founder of a religion. And same for encampments and industrial zones and all the other stuff. All of those would still count strong. You can't get away with
this. Is that it pushes everyone to pick the same way as you progress through a game.
Yeah, not necessarily. I would push it towards giving adjacency bonus reduction in cost. So if you, say, found a campus location that gives you 5 adjacency bonus, then that should be much cheaper than slapping a campus down right in the middle of a floodplain or something stupid like that.
Okay, yeah.
So you can nuance it to make it make more sense, but still require people to actually build more than just one or two districts, because that's what people do. They'll go, okay, this is a good one. We're just going to spam, say, all trade routes and all harbors.
I would rather the trade-offs between districts make you want other districts sometimes, rather than you have to build this district to keep your costs down. Like,
well, yes, but that's also make a modification to the district values and utility so that they are...
Well, then you don't need this restriction, because it would be a bad choice to build a commerce district sometimes, because you're giving up something more valuable.
Well, it depends. No matter how you try and balance individual districts, people are going to go, well, I don't want to build encampments because I don't want to go to war. And then it's like, okay, then they'll complain later on that they can't build units.
Yeah.
I mean, they do get attacked.
Well, that's fine, though. That's their penalty. It's not a contrived penalty. It's a bed they made, but that's better than saying everyone has build this district at some point.
Except that I would also say that you can't buy units either if you don't have encampments.
That's a separate consideration from the districts as a whole, but yeah, okay.
No, it makes more sense. Where you're popping it out from middle of nowhere. But anyways, long story short, there is work to be done, and that can be done on those to make them better. Elsewise, some more clarity on warmonger penalty when wiping out somebody.
Can that be tuned so that it matters? The heck with that right now. Warmonger penalty is complete trash.
Especially multiplayer, because your fellow multiplayer is no character trash all over the app.
Well, in single player, though, the hatred over relatively small actions is so great that conquering 3 cities off one civ, you might as well have wiped out Gandhi and his best buddy off the map entirely, because everyone's going to hate you similarly at that point.
Yeah.
Like, there needs to be a difference, and I said this on the forum too, there needs to be a difference between taking 3 cities and 30 cities in terms of how the AI behaves. And right now, there really isn't much, if any, difference in practice. But yes, more clarity in the UI, always, always, please. That would be helpful.
Most, I love how it says, most civilization, like, most, not all, just most,
yeah.
Unique districts now require population to construct. Like normal districts. Yay! No more free Hanzas for Germany in every single city.
All the Hanzas.
Otherwise, apparently AI got tuned, but no one's really believed that it's gotten any better, so whatever.
No, but it makes the turn times longer, apparently. People benchmark before and after the patch have observed at least a significant change in the amount of time it takes.
I am still going to posit that if they remove unit movement from the rendering engine when you turn the game thing off, that turn times would get a lot faster. Because if you actually pay attention and you know how long a unit takes to move, you can specifically count out how many units each and every single civ and city-state has on the map. Common problem with airplanes in Civ 5, and it's the same thing now. Even if you cannot see the unit, the stupid unit still gets its movement time rendered. You get rid of that, then you can talk about actual improvements to the AI and other such things.
And there's no reason for it to be there in the first place. So why are you rendering things the player isn't looking at? Just benefit is that going towards?
Yep. And the funniest part is, if you listen and you have your sound effects on, you can hear if people are fighting.
Yeah.
Because you can hear the sound effects that go along with all that stuff.
Well, I've noticed that in Turncast during turns, because Link Mackie's blasting field cannons off in somewhere. And then she,
field cannons are really loud.
And then she gives me the siege engine rolling forever bug.
Oh, yes.
That one's just stupid. I don't even. Didn't do it on purpose.
Yeah.
I troll occasionally, but I didn't make the game do that.
You can easily self-troll yourself with that, too.
Exactly.
That's true. That's true.
Otherwise, bugs got fixed. Probably new bugs got added.
Yep.
Well, duh.
Big ticket items here. First, in multiplayer, fixed an issue that could cause private MP games to become public. Ah, the pause bug. Ah, thank you, thank you, thank you. Not sure how you did that, because I was introduced in the last patch. Speaking of fixing a bug and then introducing another one. Fixed an issue where incomplete encampment districts were able to attack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess they'll just build an encampment. LOL.
I've only put one warranty into it, but I can shoot at you. Pew, pew.
But it was the AI that was doing it more often than not.
Well, yes. Yeah. And the one where there's a bug fix, but we already know and has been noted in the community that it's still not fixed completely. Fixed an issue where you could declare war on friends or allies by moving units. Guess what? You can still nuke your allies.
Yeah. Later.
Technically, that's not moving a unit.
Well, it is. You are launching the new. It has to.
Well, the unit had to move.
The unit moves before it explodes. Otherwise, it's just going to go off and.
But they didn't.
Sorry.
But you didn't declare war on them by moving. You don't declare war on them by exploding it, because they're still your ally, despite the fact that you can carpet nuke them.
Very comprehensive on the patch. If you're listening to this and you've played Civilization VI at all in the last month, you probably already have it. 819 megabyte download. And if you're like, oh, I'm still not certain if I'm running the patch, the game version is 1.0.0.56, and you may need to restart Steam if it hasn't already downloaded for you. So there.
Or get interwebs.
There's still that too.
Civ 6 welcomes the return of Poland now. We have Poland again added if you have Deluxe Edition or you just buy the DLC. Either way will work.
You have Jad Wiga
as the leader. Jad. Let's call her Jad. A winged hussar and a unique building that is, I would probably butcher the pronunciation of that. We'll just say, suck nice. There we go.
Yeah,
we'll just cut out the middle part. Poland's unique ability is the Golden Liberty. It allows you to shower your opponent in culture by building a fort or encampment near them. Basically a culture bomb, you know.
Yay, culture bomb.
You shower them in culture with your Golden Liberty ability.
Important clarifications made by Ed Beach, Civ 6 lead designer, on his Twitter feed. It can only steal tiles within 3 spaces of claiming a city. Also, you can't claim finished districts or wonders, so...
Oh, dang it!
But you can claim wonders under construction, and there's an achievement related to that, so have fun with that.
Yep. Yeah.
You also, as a part of the Golden Liberty, okay, you get the military policy slot changed into a wild card slot.
Basically, pull a grease, go straight to +2 profit points, or +2 great scientist points.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's a wild card slot, so you can still put military policies into it.
That's right. There's no downside. It's just a nice little extra there. She can also spread religion to nearby a city when you gain the territory using Golden Liberty. That's not going to come into play too much, but it's there. You can shower them in your religion as well as culture.
I don't know. That's a great way to do it very often. Like, hey, look, I dropped a settler on your border between a couple of cities. Fort, steal your territory. So, yay.
I guess.
It's a mid-game thing, because you're not spamming encampments everywhere, but you can spam forts.
That's assuming that you, like, really want to spread your religion to that extent. But, okay.
Well, if you are going religion, or you built a religion where spreading it means more money for you or more other stuff for you.
Yeah, if you're cherry tapping or doing variant play or whatever, it's there.
Yeah.
I got the famous Winged Hussar, as they say. It's famous, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
It's strong attack and can push back defending units. The YouTube video associated with this from Firaxis is a little more clarity on it. Basically, if you do more damage to them than they do to you, you shove them. And if they have nowhere to which they can be shoved, you do more damage. So that's nice.
Yeah, that's good.
Somebody's going to put all the units in a corner with Wing Hussar.
Yep.
It's around in town. Sure.
Just don't put baby in a corner. You see, kids, there is this move.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing you can do with the stuck knife is that it gives bonus production from foreign trade routes and gold from internal trade routes. So you're making up the suckier aspect of your given trade route by getting extra yields of that type in spite of you doing it. Now the stucky part of your trade route is nice. That's why it's called the stuck knife. You got a scenario here. You have to defend Poland, Frigg, and Vienna from invaders, including the Teutonic Knights and Ottoman Turks, and you gain glory in battle. So just go kill stuff, basically. Mm. Just like any other game of Civ. It's all you should ever be doing. There's also a Viking scenario pack, but I haven't played it, but it's there. You can go with a Viking. I don't have much to say about it personally.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the Viking scenario pack is even if you don't do anything with the scenario, it does add 6 new city-states to the base game and 3 new natural wonders to the base game.
Okay.
Yeah. And have fun pronouncing the first one.
Yeah, I was just looking at that going,
how do that?
Wow, I don't think I'm the only one that would butcher that one. Wow, yeah.
Yeah, no. I call it A.
Hey, listen.
That's its name.
Yeah.
Well, once we figure out what it actually looks like, then we can make up a better name for it.
So, about the community's reaction to this DLC.
Suck it.
That has generally been their response. Poland,
they did not use suck nice, okay.
Yeah. Oh.
A lot of the negative feedback is not so much about the DLC itself, but more about what is missing from the game still, or things that need to be improved from the game. So you need to take that with a grain of salt when you're looking at, some of the people don't, the whininess. However, it is still worth noting that on Steam, Poland, mostly negative, only 29% positive, and for the Viking scenario, only 5% are positive, which, if you compare that with Civilization V DLC, where the worst performer was Mixed, that was the Cradle of Civilization America, with only 60% being a positive review, that is noteworthy.
Not really. There's more people reviewing things on Steam now than there was then.
Well, it's not just about
about
the numbers.
Glaring issues in the game that are not fixed by the patch or DLC, and so it's vexing to see DLC, but that's not the DLC.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is if a lot of this is just a knee-jerk reaction? Because why did you give us DLC without fixing these other things? And is that rating going to change and go back up afterward?
People whine on Steam and never go back to change it.
Oh, yeah, no.
You get new reviews, though. That. Like, if the game were to be, like, suddenly amazing in terms of AI and UI, like, a month from now, it's not going to happen. But if it were to, your future reviews for this would probably be higher just from Halo Effect. You would expect a better review generally for any aspect of the game because the game has gotten a lot better than it was previously.
Yeah.
But I do think it is worth noting just how negative the response has been to the DLC, with the caveat that, yes, sometimes it's not strictly speaking about the DLC. And perhaps it's more about, rather than having some DLC now, how about going back and fixing some of the issues with the base game?
Welcome back to Civ 5 whining that DLC was put out early instead of constantly fixing stuff. Yada, yada, yada.
Vanilla was a travesty on release.
It was.
To be fair.
It was, though. It really was. But if you think about it, they're putting out these small DLCs that don't actually affect things so that they can make money to pay for the patching. So
I do not buy or subscribe to that position, but this isn't the time.
Well, you can choose to disagree, but it's still business, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's still business, but the DLC is basically funding more DLC. It's not funding, realistically, overhauls to things that need it as much. It's not what happens in practice.
Yeah, it sort of is, yeah.
It sort of is, but fixing bugs and stuff like that is like a rung or two down in priority compared to just making more DLC.
Well, that's
part
of practice.
Again. There are significant problems in Civ 5 right now that never got fixed that could have been fixed. That's Civ 5, not 6.
Eh?
Want to tell me which DLC was funding those fixes that never happened? I don't know.
Yeah, actually, well, with Civ 5, they didn't do anything after the last expansion. If they had still did DLC after the last expansion, then you would probably see a lot more patch fixes.
Yeah, maybe then they would have made unit cycling workable. Maybe.
Maybe. And then they could have copied it over.
Yeah, but I will still maintain that the degree of negativity on the DLC is worth noting because of the larger systemic issues with Civilization VI.
Anyway, Viking scenario, some of the city-states actually help different play styles, so that's kind of nice.
Auckland, additional production for coastal tiles. Ooh. So maybe if you're just like, oh, I missed out on the Pantheon for specifically for resources in the sea. Hey, you could obviously stack with it too. but there's also, I just call it Anti. I don't know, Anti Navario. Culture bonus that increases with every great person earned. There's, I just call it Armagach. Sounds Klingon. Hate mail. Builders can construct the monastery improvement, which provides faith and heals religious units. I find them underwhelming, the improvements to tiles. They're a nice flavor, but I don't consider them, oh my gosh, must have.
Well, you could say build the healing religious unit tile improvement out in the fourth ring, and then not have to like jam-pack all your stupid religious units around a single holy site.
Certainly situational, I'm not saying it's never useful. Granada, build and construct the Alcazar improvement, which protects military units and provides culture. Okay.
Fort, basically.
Yeah. Muscat, bonus amenities in cities with a commercial hub. Okay. And then there's improved growth for cities with a campus from Palenque. Specifically, the city growth rate is 15% higher. It's plus one amenity cities from Muscat. Alcazar is plus two culture. Monastery was plus two faith. And Magic already mentioned the healing. Oh, it's plus 2% culture for each great person it has ever earned from Anti.
Okay. That's actually eventually really, really, really big.
Yes.
Depending on how you do that, that could make it to the point where you just never build a cedar district because you're already done the civic tree.
Yeah.
All right, we had feedback on the Christmas special, which I wasn't on, so why wasn't there more whining?
Because you weren't on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, you see what I did there.
Well, King Chris mentioned that he'd like to see corporations and the satellite layer return together. It wouldn't be returning because it was never in Civ, but putting satellite layer in Civ, I think, is what he's saying.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
So those listening corporations, we were talking initially, we saw Civilization IV and the satellite layer, the Civ title that Magic will not name, Beyond Earth, but I'll name it.
So one of the corporations, either A, generated by great people, nah, B, produced by Wonderstyle, or C, mixture, still don't like it. It would be satellite related. Okay, I still want you, yeah, no. Got to be a better way than making it Great Person or Wonder Style.
Attach it to commercial districts. Wahaha. Or attach a given type of corporation to districts.
Or make them slightly different so that you're not doing weird stuff with stuff.
No, you must do weird stuff with stuff.
I like it attaching it, Phil suggesting, to an existing mechanic, just because of how late it's probably and oddly should come into the game.
Yeah.
The only question is how you interact with it and what it confers, like what your incentive is to use it.
And so what King Chris says, the one that builds this corporation may build satellites for the satellite layer, but anyone else in the game can only purchase satellites from the Civ that produces this corporation. Now that sort of thing I could probably get along with, but I wouldn't leave it to a specific, this corporation builds satellites for satellite layer. No. But if you build a spaceport and you happen to have a corporation related to the satellite layer, then other civs could, say, through that corporation buy access to your spaceport to launch up satellites. Non-military, obviously, unless you're allied, and then military. And then you can make money sort of that way. Because spaceports technically are a path to victory, but not necessarily on the path to victory, because you get stuff for building spaceports anyways, or at least the first one.
Yeah, your satellites can become like a new frontier for trade routes.
Yeah,
and actual trade routes where the person who receives the trade route also receives a benefit, not just the person who sends the trade route. Thank you, Civ 6.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's another topic.
Yep. But yes, because I wouldn't mind something along that line, because then it'd be like, not everybody has spaceports, because the real world, not everybody has spaceports. Yeah, if you don't have to build one, just send up satellites, that'd be cool.
I'm not sure I like the real-world argument for much in Civ 6, but yeah.
No, okay, but still, it's not like, hey, look, we can all build spaceports. Yay! Why don't we do it? Because it's freaking expensive.
Well, that's why I don't build them in Civ 6, personally.
That too. constructing a GPS satellite can make all your trade routes immune to plunder. No, that's not really immune to plunder. We have GPS satellites everywhere. Pirates still get the trade routes.
Although pirates don't get the trade routes too much from the people who have GPS satellites, but that's not because of the GPS satellite.
No, it's because the people with GPS satellites sent a navy over.
Yeah. Correlation and causality and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, construct a GPS satellite makes, I don't know, the trade routes of others more susceptible to being plundered because we can track them more easily. Not that I'm saying I would want that, but I would think he could actually make a stronger argument for that.
That would be amazing.
And then you could say, through a corporation, sell access to the GPS network to other nations instead of them having to go do it themselves. You can just sell access.
Yeah, exactly. At an incredible markup, like ringtones. Woo!
Go ringtones. Otherwise, espionage ability, hostile takeover. Of course, you're trying to use spies to gain control of corporations, which I would say no. If there was spies related to stealing techs and other stuff like that, then cool. I'd be fine with that. If, say, a corporation was related to science and then you went and raided the corporation and you got a tech boost doing that rather than just, you know, generic campus, that'd be nice.
I can see it just being like another mission that you have instead of, oh, I'm going to siphon all this gold or I'm going to get all of this science, then some other quantity that on that moment when you successfully complete that mission, you get a one-time boost. It's not – you have control over the corporation until what? The Civ then launches their own espionage ability and then has a hostile takeover and takes it back?
Or just says, nope.
Yeah.
We're doing a hostile takeover. Nope. No, you're not. Shut up. But we're spies. Yeah, I know. That's not how this works. And corporations tradable through diplomacy? I'm pretty sure corporations rather will be like, what? Isn't that slavery?
That would be nationalization of your assets. Get right. Yeah.
I would actually like to see a deeper plan for that, where different government types can allow for different policies that do that sort of thing, so that you can have, say, the nationalized resources plan where you make all the money, but say you get some sort of negative, or you have the capitalist corporate plan where you free market it and you don't have direct access to over a lot of your yields, but you get stuff faster or cheaper or something like that. That would be a useful expansion-related thing when it comes to corporations, is to expand more than just, oop, here's a new corporation, expand the politics side of it and the control side of it as well, along with a few other things, make it more interesting overall.
Of course, now I'm thinking about, maybe we should add, what would be a funny term, like a corpocracy or something as a civic, as a government type.
There you go. And let the corporates take over, ha-ha. Corporations integrating into the World Congress. Sure.
We'll just let that happen. Good.
Yep. No problem. Just let the corporates take over the UN. And then legalized freedom popped up. In regards to whether Civ 6 was rushed, apparently I was not here for that discussion.
No, that was the Christmas special. Yeah.
Yeah, we established you weren't present.
Yeah, he agrees that rushed isn't the right word, because obviously it was not. I'll figure that whatever they decide to include in this release version should be competently functional, even though it means couldn't get something in. Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's better to have competently functional versus, well, we've got a thin layer of this, and it doesn't really work without this other stuff that we didn't really get around to building, but you don't know that we didn't get around to building this, so now you're going to be pissed at us for putting in that little thing.
Falls under the general heading, sometimes less is more.
Yeah. It's not always a good option, but yeah, sometimes companies do that sort of thing because bad planning and other stuff. I still only see a few game companies who understand concept of feature production and integration properly. Eventually, maybe more game companies will realize how to build things better and not be as sloppy, but that will take a lot of time.
There were a number of suggestions made for things to cover, and as I said in response on Civilization Fanatic Center, we're going to save some of those for episodes this year. Like, they are whole separate topics that would take more than the 5 or 10 minutes at most that we would take with topics on the Christmas special. Just given the number and the depth of questions that we had, I felt it would be cheap to try to cover some of those topics in that format. So they have not been forgotten. Wanted to say it on the show itself. We'll be right back.
Our previous episode was totally not just a lame clip show. Number 20, apparently. Wow, we
it
have a lot
was.
Of extra clips.
Wow.
Oh. It's not 20, it's double X. Like, be special and stuff.
Congratulations, you're both.
Oh, they're trying to bring back one of those movies. Why? But they're doing it.
I did say some good stuff. We had original Civs co-designer Bruce Shelley on talking about the board game influences. There was an interview with him that we talked about. We did it for episode 250, that got cut. And then we had a really, really, really long talk about trademarks.
Yeah.
Somebody decided to use the Civ trademark, and then, no, that was bad.
They didn't really use the Civ trademark outright, but...
No, but they made something that was in a similar genre, and Civ is enough of a big name in the genre that somebody would see that, and if they, for people that are more casual, might not know the difference.
My takeaway from it is that it looks more like copyright infringement that got tagged as trademark for convenience.
Yeah, easier to explain. But we had an expert to explain it. So. Yeah.
For feedback, I think legalized freedom.
Yeah, yep. He and I disagree on this. Needless to say.
Although he was raising an eyebrow that Civ was in it for making money. Well, doesn't everybody like to make money, even if they want to make a great game? I mean, that's not two opposing goals.
Nope.
If you were truly trying to optimize for money no matter what, then, yeah, you probably wouldn't pick gaming. But, you're still trying. You still have to make money.
I want to do everything that I can do that I love doing. I also want to make money with it.
Yeah.
Personally, I think legalized freedom, based on, the overall commentary in it, I think his general thing was that he believes back in the day, game developers were artists and not business people, and that they were doing it for the love of the game and the art, and wasn't that so awesome that they did it for that because they could make a lot of money off of it? No. That's not really what they were doing.
No.
You're going to have some, but not really.
When the original Civilization was in development, it was developed by a company called Microprose, a company, as I said on CFC in response, the underlying practical purpose of making a game as part of a company is by the very nature of being a company to make money and to make a profit. I certainly think that there's a pride in game development for some people, and we have seen that in Civ, and we continue to see that in Civ, where there's continuing support afterwards, even if it's, I'm sorry, I already have your money. But this notion that at some point, as Matt already pointed out, that game developers change from artists to businessmen, which is a direct quote from Legalized Freedom, no. Now, Legalized Freedom did respond to mine, where he said, thing is, if his primary goal was making money, he would have gone to work in a more robust industry, which is what Magin cited. I think that the primary motivation was the desire to make games and hopefully make enough money to live on and keep it going.
clearly bullshit.
Make as much money as you can.
The fact that they were charging money for it, now you could say, well, maybe they were only thinking about charging money in order to recoup costs, so that it wouldn't be a financial drain on them that they were just trying to get into the black. But no, the fact that it was part of a company, they were charging money for it. Now, I think it's fair to say that we would like to do for our job at least something that we don't hate day after day after day. We're already going to have bad days, but if you're kind of thinking, oh, I got to make games again today, then I think that would probably come through in the final product. And yes, you probably wouldn't be making money. The fact that you have a passion for it is going to increase the likelihood that you are going to make some money. And hopefully the money that you are coming in, or at least generate some kind of income that you're able to cover expenses. And then you've got money that you can pay yourself, other employees, other people that you need to pay for, et cetera, all of your expenses. So that's fine. So I don't think there was an artist to businessman, nor do I think that making games is completely about business, although there are certainly people in the gaming industry that they are focused on bottom line.
It's like a sliding scale. One end is all artistic, the other end is all business, and the majority of developers are somewhere there in the middle.
Exactly.
Yep.
They do have a love of the game, or they wouldn't be in this industry at all, really, but they do also want to have games that are successful. It just depends on how much that they are, whether they feel like sacrificing some of the artistry for the business.
That's really true. Even back then, they were still somewhere in the middle. They had a passion for gaming, and that's great. Passion for building games, that's awesome. But they aren't doing it for free. And the whole, they used to be artists kind of gives you the belief that they're like, oh, well, maybe we'll make some money off it, but we're doing it for the love of the game, and other people will enjoy our game, and we'll eat socks because no one paid us for it.
No, they wanted definitely to be paid for it. Even the people that were super passionate about it still wanted to be paid for it on yeah. some level. Even if it was just to break even and so they could have food on the table. Mm-hmm. Even the guy who makes Dwarf Fortress, he gets enough to live on, and that's good for him because he gets to keep developing the game and he gets to eat and he's happy. But not everybody is that guy.
Exactly. And even still, that guy still doesn't want to make a shitty game so that he doesn't make money. That guy wants to make a good game that will sell so that he can make money to keep doing stuff.
Yeah.
Or, like, other people who might want to make a really good game so that they can hire more people to make the next version of the game even better, and therefore it can't, you know, be crap.
Yes. Stardew Valley is another great example. That guy did it by himself, wanted to make this game, but he also wanted to make money off it. Whoever actually 100% did it out of the love of the game?
They had to be nowadays where everything is free. This is where this sort of mentality comes up. It's newer mentality that they were artists because they weren't. All the tools are free, and therefore people can do it for the love of the art. And somebody else is paying their bills. But back in the day, tools weren't free.
Yeah. The modding community, because it's so extensive these days, a lot of that work is done for free just for the love of the game. But it's hard to take all of that and make an entire whole game out of it.
Yeah, especially when you have to pay people for the use of the stuff that somebody else already paid for to let you do it for free. But I'm thinking like indie community stuff. There are games out there that are literally just, we built it for fun and that's cool. People like it. Awesome. But they're still charging money for it. So.
Yeah, even if it's just in the form of asking for donations.
Yep. There might be some rose-colored glasses going on there.
Well, if you go back to one of the game series I love from the 80s, Ultima, that started out as just a side project that the original creator did, and he was programming it by himself initially, but he was wanting to make money from this as an alternate thing as to taking a normal path. He wanted to do something different. Well, eventually grew into an actual company and ended up getting bought out by EA, and that went totally well. Even if he had a love for the doing the thing and just wanting to do it, but he also wanted to share that with people, but not necessarily for free.
And for Sid specifically, Sid worked at a company that made games. This was not his first game at this company. They were already making games, and it was a company. He was getting paid to build a game.
Indeed.
Also, at that point, he wasn't the one in charge. So, yeah, he was getting paid.
Yes.
We didn't have all this digital distribution that we do nowadays. Make that easier. This is back in the day when you still had to put it on a disc.
Yep. Well, it's also you had to put it on a disc so it better worked.
Yep.
You had spent more time QAing it back then than you do now.
So, speaking of alternate paths to making money, after 10 years, in the 11th season of Polycast, you're going to be able to hear the start of each topic, and then if you want to hear our conclusion to the topic, pay $9.95 a month. No, I'm kidding.
We've reached the conclusion.
Yeah, the funny grilling businessman.
Dan is no longer in his group.
I'm a money grubbing business artist. Thank you very much. Okay, so. But in
artist, that's a new one.
Of course, but for the fifth year in a row, we asked our listeners, for feedback. And we're going to be talking about it on this episode as well as the next episode. We're going to talk about questions 1 to 9. And that starts with the very first question, which was whether or not people wanted us to be recording more than every other week, whether it was every other week, weekly, or monthly. And as I already told Majid, Mackie, and Phil, I've decided that I'm going to retire this question. You're not going to see this question again.
Have we ever had an answer of more?
Well,
other than one or two people?
We keep getting the same stuff.
The thing is, when I look at the history, and yes, I have a whole other separate document that compares the summaries from 2011, 2016, as time has gone on, there's been an increased general preference for bi-weekly over weekly, and I think part of that might just be the audience resignation that, of course, it's going to be bi-weekly. back to artistry versus being business, we are doing this for free. We are not getting paid for this. So in addition to the time to record the episodes, doing that every week would be very difficult for us as a panel to do because we do other things than Polycast with our life.
Yeah.
I know, take a breath.
Allegedly.
And that's not just Play Civ.
I guess that's the other thing. In order to really be on this podcast, we have to play Civ 2, and we really could be cultivating real life relationships when we're doing that. So it's a big sacrifice. And...
Yeah, we know where you were last week, Dan.
Yep.
I really don't see what that has to do with anything. Just just the fact that my girlfriend and I took a trip to Quebec City is completely irrelevant. Uh-huh. I was thinking about Polycast next to never during the time. But it was in there, maybe, possibly. But the other thing is, people who've listened to the show long enough know, particularly if you listen to the live format and then the post-produced version, even once, I'm very particular about my editing. So to do that in a weekly format, that's just not happening. But yes, the preference was for bi-weekly. Essentially 70% of the respondents said that this was our first preference, and then to do weekly, and then to do monthly. So Polycast case, sometimes less is more. That is that. For question number two, with descriptions, the following segments were considered for inclusion on one or more episodes of Polycast in 2016. Check all that you feel should be included in episodes in 2017. And the Senate segment, which is debating game strategies, was actually first on a strategy podcast. I know, isn't that right?
Well, that hasn't always been true, has it?
Yeah.
This is the sixth survey that we've done. This was only the third time that Senate was first. It's actually been every other year that Senate's been first. Even though it was at 88%, it had one more vote than Forum Talk, which was investigating hot issues raised in civ community forums. And that itself was one vote ahead of news. So we will recover 2 weeks' worth of topical civilization-related items. And really, actually, in today's case, we were covering a month's worth. So they were
topical anymore.
Well, and topical is a relative term. And when we talk about topical civilization-related items, we are talking about timeliness. We're not talking about things that you apply to your skin. That's a different topical.
And we will rub it in, though.
Yeah.
Always. The only topics that got less than 50% favor were community focus, highlighting a specific segment in the civ community, time machine, looking back at key moments in civ history, and I actually found amusing that at the bottom was miscellaneous, that which does not fall into any of the other categories. Miscellaneous is really kind of the default. If it doesn't fit into any of the categories otherwise, and that does happen, I can tell you right now, miscellaneous is sticking around.
Dan, that's their way of telling us to stay on topic.
We reserve the right to talk about other
stay
things.
On topic.
The thing is, sometimes I actually categorize things as miscellaneous from the beginning. But yeah, anyway.
apparently, they don't want you doing that. They want you to properly categorize it. And too bad if you can't.
Think of new categories, Dan.
Yeah, Dan.
We haven't introduced a new segment on the show in a while, but that's because we're talking about successive Civilization titles. We're not talking about other games, and for all of their differences, there are enough similarities that really the segments that we already have are very broad, and they cover quite the wide spectrum. So I wouldn't
We did actually talk about games that weren't Civ last year.
Yes, there are always exceptions, and not just last year, but in years past. You're right. But for the most part, we're talking about Civ, and even then, it might have even been under the miscellaneous segment, but we found an existing segment name to put that under. So what I think is more likely to happen is rather than coming up with new segments, we change their focus or we modify it slightly. But we'll continue to, I can't believe I'm going to use this word in the context of previous conversation, but fine. We're going to continue to massage the nature of the and this sounds like Phil's already getting started.
Yes, yes, yes.
Briefly on passion and dialogue. Passion showing excitement in what is being said, and dialogue connecting with the show's audience. We ask people to rank us on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is you're perfect and 1 is atrocious. Passion, we're at an 8.2 as a median, and a dialogue at 7.7, which was actually the first drop year over year in some time. Maybe that was just because some of our initial apprehension when they were talking about Civilization VI being in development, and then we saw certain videos and certain comments and wondered what this was going to look like in practice.
No, we just got worse.
You get bored.
Balance of coverage. I was actually expecting it to be a little closer between Civilization V and Civilization VI, and absolutely not at all. 58% said they wanted Civilization VI first, then Civ V, then Civ in general. And then 28% said they wanted Civilization VI first, Civ in general, and then Civ V. So you combine all that together, 85% of the 43 people who responded to the survey said they wanted us to cover Civilization VI first and foremost. Loud and clear.
So, despite the weirdness in the community and the Steam play where it's actually about 50-50 or bouncing in between those,
yes.
At least for Polycast, we'll focus on Civ 6.
We've put a lot of time on Civ 5 at this point.
Only like, 5 years worth.
There's not a lot new in regards to, say, that strategy topic to discuss at this point.
And most of the Civ 5 discussion would be better on modcasts, because that's where their real activity is.
True.
Yes, the continuing modding development. And yes, there are still recent topics on Civilization 5 and community forums, but it's, oh wait, we talked about that before. It's just another thread on something that was last discussed maybe a year or two ago, and then for whatever reason or reasons, they just didn't find the previous thread, which is understandable. Similar things or exact things come up at different times. So, promotion avenues. I'm also considering retiring this question as well, even though it was just introduced in 2013. For some reason, promotion avenues, fan communities top the list again. The one difference, though, so this is why I say I may replace this, because I figured after 3 years of essentially the same order, it was fan communities, YouTube, and Twitter, with comparable percentages. All of a sudden now, Reddit jumps to second, YouTube goes down third, and Twitter falls off. I was a little surprised by that, but at the same time, with the new Civilization coming out and its promotion and the discussion on Reddit, as well as in community forums, maybe it really isn't that much of a surprise.
Reddit is kind of a community forum, sort of.
Kind of. Kind of.
If you find the right place. There's a difference between, say, the Civ 6 subreddit and the Civ subreddit, or the 4X subreddit, or the TBS subreddit, or the strategy subreddit, or the...
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Elsewise, 2016 was the first year for our Patreon support, thanks to all of those who are continuing to support us. And essentially, what it came down to was the top responses were those who said that I'm currently not a patron, but then either to say they intended to become one, or they are not intending to become one. There really was negligible difference. The top was, I'm not one, and I have no intention of becoming a patron, and I'm not one, and I do intend to become one. And of course, I phrased that specifically. I wasn't asking anyone for a commitment, even though if I even phrased it that way, as really a way that I could hold them to it, even if I said, I'm not one, but I am
a commitment.
Yes. Imagine remembering his line from the promo that we did. Some people support the show by being on the show in addition to listening to the show, or there are some people who are on the show and never listen to the show. I always find that an odd dichotomy. There are some people that provide feedback, either in written form or in verbal form or a combination of the two. But if you are willing and able to support us financially, have a look at us on Patreon. Questions 8 and 9 about guests for return appearance and favorite regular co-hosts. Congratulations to Scott. Alpha Shard Dirk, our most frequent guest co-host, is now for the third year in a row in top spot for who listeners want to see return. He had 66% of the vote. It was a tie for Candace Albinus and QNL in second at 58%, and Canuck Soldier placing for the first time on this list at 55%. What I think is the most encouraging from this is only 12% of respondents selected nobody. But then in terms of favorite regular co-host, in the past, Matt has been number one twice. Phil has been number one twice. Last year, I was second and Mackie was first. And this year, we have flipped that. So I was first, 37%, followed by Mackie at 28%. So
congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. I always vote for Mackie. So.
Thanks to everyone who.
Dun, 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 dun.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month to month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to the 272nd edition of Polycast here in 2017. That's 680 post-leap. Yeah, that's the math problem there for you. Figure it out. Joined by Makalua.
You just made my brain hurt with math on a Saturday morning. Ah.
Translation from Mackie. Thank you. The mean teacher.
No.
I am also a teacher of Civ strategy.
True.
Translation from Phil. Troll-o-lo-lo-lo-lo-lo-lo-lo. Match in.
The usual.
Still with interwebs. One and a bit weeks to go.
Translation for Imagine, hashtag first world problems. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Translation for Imagine, something something crazy?
Uh-huh. Nobody minds if we do if they're still listening to this podcast.
Record date?
January 7th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth's Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.